It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Biden administration has approved plans from 35 states, including Wisconsin, detailing how we will roll out our part of an ambitious national electric vehicle charging network. It means $900 million in national electric vehicle infrastructure funding will start flowing to states to create this national fast charging network for EVs. We talk about where the EV market is headed with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Jamie Page Deaton is here, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, a member of the jury for the North American Car, Truck, and Utility of the Year Award. Jamie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we look at Wisconsin, California plans to ban the sale of new gas cars starting in 2035. How big of a deal is this?
This is a pretty big deal. California is the largest new car market in the United States. I mean, California's economy, just California's, is like the fifth largest in the world. This is a huge market that automakers ignore kind of at their peril. So if California is saying that by 2035, you can't sell gasoline cars here, well, automakers are going to have to pay attention to that and adjust to that new reality.
California is called the nation's electrification pioneer. Why has it kind of, how has it been able to stake its claim in EVs? And why is it such a trendsetter?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, across the country, EVs make up about 2, maybe 3% of new car sales. In California, they're 16% of new car sales. And, you know, what happens there is, you know, a lot of Californians have been directly impacted by climate change with increasing wildfires and mudslides. And so you have a population there who is very interested in doing what they can to roll back their carbon footprint. And then on top of that, you have a government that's willing to back them up with subsidies, as well as, you know, various perks if you have an electric car. I mean, they have a great program. Well, I mean, it's great if you're an electric car owner where you can use the carpool lanes, avoid some of that notorious California traffic. So it's really kind of a perfect storm of factors for California to really take the lead on this, particularly because, again, they have that huge market. So they have the leverage with automakers to really push them in the direction of developing the kind of cars that California wants on the road.
Looking at the incentives and the subsidies you just mentioned, the president signing the climate bill last month, does it give enough incentives for car buyers and rewards for car makers to really bring EVs and this transition, you know, this switchover to happen? What do you see out of these subsidies and incentives?
So the new subsidies and incentives that President Biden just signed into law, like, these are much better than previous incentives and subsidies and tax breaks for electric vehicles. So, for example, it used to be that if you were buying, you know, a hybrid or electric vehicle, you could get a tax credit of up to $7,500. The thing is that was non-transferable. So that meant that you could, you know, if you bought the car in September, you had to wait, you know, until April when you did your taxes to take that break. And that meant that it didn't effectively, for most people, lower the price of the car. The new incentives for new cars, it's still about $7,000, but it's transferable. So what you can do is you can give that tax credit to the dealer, and that effectively lowers the price of the car by up to $7,500. Now, the actual formula depends on a lot of things, such as your income. You know, a big criticism of previous incentives has been like, hey, this is just incentives for rich people to buy EVs. Mm-hmm. Now it's capped. So if you make over, I think it's over $150,000 a year, you can't take full advantage of this. This also, the formula for the incentive also takes into account how much of, or how many of the parts on the car were, you know, built in the United States. So it gives domestic automakers and automakers who onshore production, it gives them an incentive to do so because it effectively will make their cars less expensive for consumers. The other nice thing about it is, if you want to buy a used EV, you still get incentives. You can get up to $4,000 in tax credits that you can use to lower the price of the vehicle if you're buying a used EV. So these incentives are going to be, they make it a lot easier for people to afford these cars. They're a lot less complicated, since you don't really have to work it into your taxes or anything like that. And they're going to make EVs a lot more available to a wider swath of car buyers.
Talking about the future of the auto industry with Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, you can join in with your questions about EVs, what you're watching for with the transition away from gas-powered vehicles, 800-642-1234. Brad is joining us from Eau Claire. Brad, hi. What would you like to ask?
Yes, good morning. I would like to add the conversation. I've called in about this before, about hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. I think rather than going to electric vehicles, we should be going to hydrogen fuel cell. They're already using them in California. I tried to purchase one for here in Wisconsin, but since we don't have the infrastructure to deliver the fuel, they won't sell them out of the state of California.
Brad, thank you for that question. You know, California's plan allowing for the sale of hydrogen fuel cell cars. Jamie, could that technology end up dominating?
You know, it could. It really comes down to, though, like Brad mentioned, the infrastructure. If you're going to have a hydrogen fuel cell, and just so, everybody understands, this is a car that's powered by hydrogen, which creates electricity, which is used to create electricity, which then propels the car. And it's actually really neat because it has a tailpipe, but only water vapor comes out of it. So it really is a very good technology, and it's, much more similar to how we currently live with gas cars, where you're used to driving to a station when you need fuel, you get it, you go on your way. But there are not very many hydrogen fuel stations around the country. There are, in fact, still very few in California. Honda and Toyota bet pretty big on hydrogen fuel cell vehicles rather than EVs. And now as EVs are really taking off more than hydrogen, they're having to scramble a little bit. The main difference there is while a hydrogen vehicle is, more similar to how we fill up with gas now, without the infrastructure for either EVs or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, EVs are going to win because people have plugs in their houses. So even if there aren't public charging stations, they at least have a way to charge their car at home, whereas there's no real way to get hydrogen to fuel your car if you're not in one of the areas like California where automakers are selling them. So without, massive spending for the infrastructure, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are not likely to overtake EVs. And right now, EVs seem to really be kind of the darlings of, consumers, the government, and automakers. So, I don't really foresee a big push towards hydrogen vehicles, although, as Brad noted, they are good, and you can fuel them up a lot faster than you can charge an EV. It's just a matter of actually getting that fuel.
Brad, thank you for that question. You mentioned the darling there, EVs being the darling of the federal government, the Biden administration's goal for half of all new cars sold nationwide to be electric by 2030. What do auto companies need to do in order to meet that kind of goal?
So they're going to need to do a couple things. The first and most important is they're going to need to secure their supply chains. Because one of the big issues that's kind of facing EVs is making sure that we have enough materials to actually build the batteries. So we need a lot of these rare earth minerals. And so automakers have kind of learned their lesson from the pandemic and the war in Ukraine, sending oil prices higher, which is they have to control their own supply chain. So you see a lot of automakers like Tesla and Ford actually getting into kind of the mining and battery business to make sure that they have those supply chains in place so that they can make these cars. The other thing that they really need to do is they need to make the EVs more affordable. Now, it's understandable why EVs are so expensive right now. Automakers have invested a lot in their development, and they need to, recoup that investment. But we're starting to see the prices of EVs slowly start to come down a little bit. And that's what's really going to help widespread adoption of electric vehicles is making sure that they are affordable for, you know, the average person. And then beyond that, you know, the infrastructure issue is a real big one. That's why we see a lot of automakers actually investing in, you know, public charging companies and things like that. But those are really the three main things. It comes down to securing the materials needed to actually build the cars, making sure that consumers can afford the cars, and then making sure that the infrastructure is in place so that it's easy to drive the cars without having to worry about range or a major change in, you know, your traveling habits.
Range anxiety. Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, our guide to the EV manufacturing boom, how we should think of EVs as consumers. Join in on driving range, charging time, what comes standard, questions, or, you know, the used EV market also up for discussion. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden addressing carmakers at the Detroit Auto Show.
You know, you all know I'm a car guy. I'm here because the auto show and the vehicles here give me so many reasons to be optimistic about the future. And I really mean it. Just looking at them and driving them, they just give me a sense of optimism, although I like the speed, too.
Like the speed to audio from PBS NewsHour. Jamie Page Deaton here, editor-in-chief at Car Talk, stays with us. Let's go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, morning. I was wondering about how these EVs perform in colder weather. You know, California is pretty sunny and warm most of the year. And I'm just concerned. I heard concerns about, well, what happens if they're in Wisconsin, it's below zero. Does it really affect the range a lot? And I guess my comment would be maybe 0% internal combustion might be a bridge too far. Maybe we want to, you know, settle for 95% and leave the semis and the big vehicles that might still have to be internal combustion. I'll take my comments.
Jimmy, thank you. Jamie, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is a big concern for EV range because, yeah, cold impacts it. The cold, though, might not impact it as much as people are really worried about. I mean, I think it's really easy to think, you know, if it's, you know, 20 below, then your EV's only going to drive you, you know, 5 miles, even on a full charge. And that's really not the case. Automakers, you know, with any car they make, but also the EVs, they put them through, you know, massive amounts of stress testing. There's a proving ground in northern Minnesota that they use, you know, where it gets pretty chilly, that they use to test this. And really what you'll see is, depending on how you're driving the car and how you're using the car, in extreme cold weather, you'll see a decline in range of 10 to 20%. So if you've got a 200-mile range, you know, you'll lose anywhere from 20 to 40 miles off that range. And what the kind of variables are, you know, are you trying to blast the heater to really get warmed up quickly? Are you using a lot of, you know, accessories that can use a lot of power? Are you driving really fast, or are you trying to drive, you know, more efficiently? Are you going uphill? Are you going downhill? Those types of things. But cold weather isn't going to, you know, really dramatically slash your range. It will impact it. But it's not going to, you know, take it down to zero. And I would say there's also the flip side of it, though. You know, if you're fully charging your car and say you've got an EV that has a 200-mile range and say you've got a 30-mile drive to work, you're definitely going to make it to work. And then instead of having to stand outside in the freezing weather, gassing it up on your way home, you can just pull into your garage, plug it in. And so even though your range will be cut a little bit, at least you won't have to stand outside in the freezing cold putting gas in your car.
Well, since we're talking winter, what do you see out of car makers providing all-wheel drive on the EVs? What about all-wheel drive?
Yes. So we're actually seeing a number of EVs that have all-wheel drive. The other thing to remember is Most EV, well, let's start with the gas car, right? If you have, say, a rear-wheel drive, gasoline car, you know it's terrible in the snow because all the weight's over the engine. And so what happens with an EV, though, is the weight of all the batteries and the motor, it tends to be more evenly distributed. So no matter what type of drive setup you have with an EV, if you're investing in good tires, that goes for internal combustion cars, EVs, hydrogen cars, whatever you're driving, make sure it has good tires that are appropriate for winter weather. But the EVs have a little bit of an advantage there because they have the better weight distribution. But a number of EVs are available with all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive. The Rivian RT1 truck, the Ford F-150 Lightning truck, both available, with all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive. We've got the Ford Mustang Mach-E, which also has all-wheel drive available, along with the Toyota RAV4 EV also has all-wheel drive. So you don't have to really worry about, is my range going to be cut, and then will this thing not drive, in the snow? That's really not the case. You'll be able to get pretty much anywhere you need to go.
Talking about EVs with Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief of Car Talk. Let's go to Matthew now in Stevens Point. Matthew, what would you like to bring up?
Hi. I bought a new hybrid in 2021, and I was under the assumption that the incentives were just for EVs. Is that something that I would be able to claim this year on taxes since I never used it?
It depends. So it depends on when you bought the car and what type of car it was. Because under the old incentives, hybrids were part of the incentives, but car makers only had a certain number that they could give out. So say, for example, and I'm totally making these numbers up, but just for example, GM had, after a car maker like GM or any other one sold 100,000 cars that were eligible for these incentives, then anybody who bought, the 100,000th and first car would not be eligible for them. So some automakers have, very few of these incentives kind of left, so you could claim it on your taxes. But for example, if you were buying, a GM or a Toyota or a Honda hybrid, they were out of those incentives, so you wouldn't be able to claim it. So I would check with a couple of places. One would be your accountant. Two would be the dealer where you bought the car to see what kind of situation you're in.
Do some follow-up checking there. Matthew, thank you for that. Richard now in Two Rivers. Richard, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, Jamie, I got a question. It's kind of like complicated, but okay. Electric cars have been around for a long time. And there have been many times we have been through this before, and we all know the oil companies shut it down. And what obstacles are you looking at trying to promote electric cars these days?
Yeah, so Richard is right. This is not like the first wave of electric cars or anything close. I mean, at the turn of the century, like the last one, there were electric cars available, alongside the Model T. In New York, in fact, the parking meters had chargers in them, so you could charge your electric car. They were seen as great cars for ladies. Because you didn't have to crank over the engine. This is not exactly new technology, but it is going to require a little bit of a mental shift for most drivers, and it really just comes down to, again, the charging. It does take a long time to charge most EVs at, the fastest charging stations. You'll get up to about 80% charge in 20 minutes, which, on a long road trip, that doesn't sound so bad. You plug your car in, you go use the restroom, you get a cup of coffee. But if you think about if there are three people in front of you in line and they're all taking 20 minutes, all of a sudden you have a significant inconvenience there. So it really, I think the biggest challenge is going to be changing people's mindset a little bit, making sure that there's the charging infrastructure around. But when I talk about changing people's mindset, you know, we tend to think just as Americans, like, I need to be able to drive 600 miles at the drop of a hat, although most of us don't do that. So getting people to think, okay, if I get, you know, an electric car for the vast majority of my driving, I can be emission free. And then, you know, for the two vacations, you know, two big road trips I take a year, you know, maybe I'll rent a car. So it's a little bit easier for me there. But there is, you know, the biggest kind of impediment there is consumers adopting it and consumers demanding that the infrastructure be put into place so that these cars can, you know, be driven anywhere. On top of that, too, the battery technology, like they're getting closer to longer range batteries and faster charging batteries, but that's still a little bit of a ways off. So people will just, I guess, have to deal with the inconvenience for a little while.
There's also been talk about that they're a lot less expensive to maintain than gas-powered. Is that true? Are there lower, longer-term running costs for EVs?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because there are fewer moving parts. So that means there are fewer things to break. You know, if you look at you know, a gasoline engine, you know, you have all these belts, you have all these shafts and everything. There's a lot that can go wrong there. On top of that, you have, you know, oil changes that you need to do, just your basic, you know, maintenance there. Now, EVs aren't maintenance free, but they don't need to have a lot of the work done that a gasoline car does. So your running costs tend to be a lot lower. The other thing is, you know, you can choose when to charge if you're charging at home, when to charge your EV, so you can charge it during off-peak hours, which means you can pay lower rates for the electricity. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you could save on gas by just going to the station in the middle of the night, get yourself an electricity discount, you know, at home. And so your running costs tend to be lower as well.
Pausing there with Jamie Page, Deaton, Editor-in-Chief at Car Talk. We'll pick this up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tesla delivered almost 565,000 electric vehicles in the first half of the year. What does that mean for the EV market and the competition? Jamie Page Deaton has an eye on that. Editor-in-Chief at Car Talk stays with us. Let's go to Matt in Middleton. Matt, what's your assessment of EVs?
Good morning. I guess I'm going to go the other way. I own three diesel vehicles right now, and I've been very happy with them. And I wonder why the government does not focus on renewable fuel, which diesel is one of them. It can come from soybeans, you know, or other agricultural products, come from waste cellulose from the forestry side or waste paper. And all of those sources had their carbon removed from the air when the organic material was growing. So it's a closed loop system. And we already have all of the infrastructure in place. There's no need for mining for rare earth minerals from China or making batteries or the disposal problems. So why are we so glommed on to electrification versus growing our own fuel at home?
Matt, thank you. Jamie.
Yeah, Matt is right. Like you can run vehicles on biodiesel. I'm sure maybe not all of us, but some of us have probably seen, you know, vehicles running on used French fry grease. They smell great. Highly recommend, but maybe not too close to lunchtime. You know, I think the issue here is, again, it's a matter of, you know, getting the word out and making sure that people understand, you know, the pros and cons of each. You know, a lot of people will point to ethanol, which is, you know, fuel made from corn as a renewable resource. But in actuality, it takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than ethanol actually makes. And so when we're growing a lot of these crops that could be used to create, you know, biodiesel, what we end up doing is using a lot of petroleum to do it because petroleum products end up in the fertilizer. I mean, it's used just all over the various cycle there. So it's not quite as closed as some people may think. The flip side of it as well is that still is, you know, emitting carbon. And, you know, whether or not when, you know, the material was growing, if that was enough to really kind of bring in carbon that would have been released by burning the material later, I think that's open to a little bit of debate there. And beyond that, too, right now, the infrastructure is set up for petroleum-based diesel, which is not clean, and it still leaves, you know, people vulnerable to oil prices from other nations and things like that. And so I agree with that. It would be ideal to generate some you know, renewable fuel here, you know, within the United States that doesn't, you know, that has that kind of closed or neutral carbon impact, but that hasn't really happened yet. I mean, with the diesels, what you see is the possibility of, you know, us maybe keeping emission levels at about the same as they are now, but all the science indicates that we can't leave emission levels the same as they are now. We need to reduce them drastically in order to avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change.
Matt, thank you for that question. Mark now in Madison. Mark, you're looking at battery technologies.
Yeah, good morning. Taking a broader view of what we're trying to do here, ultimately we want to be using sustainable sources of electricity. Driving a hybrid vehicle or an EV where most of the electricity is generated from coal is actually not our future, hopefully. So I follow battery technologies broadly. And one of the things that many of us are not aware of is that in the utility energy storage field, there's a huge expansion all over the world of building solar and wind farms and including very large battery storage systems. So this will help maintain and grow our sustainable energy source by having a way to store that energy when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing. And so one of the exciting things here is that many of these batteries do not use lithium. They use simple chemistries, for instance, iron and air to make rust. And I'm not kidding. It's that simple. These are plentiful materials, completely recyclable, no problems with temperature and operation or fires, anything like that. So this is just one of many chemistries coming along. I expect we're also going to see better chemistries in the transportation sector. So I wonder if our guest probably knows about some of this, what's coming in auto and transport batteries. So,
Mark, thank you. Yes, Jamie, what is coming?
Yeah, so Mark makes a couple of really good points. First, your EV isn't as clean as it could be if your electricity comes from coal. So as we see a lot of power grids shifting over to solar and wind power, you know, EVs will become cleaner and cleaner. But energy storage is a big issue. We see whole house battery packs. Tesla has one. They haven't rolled it out as widely as they maybe could, but it's basically just a wall of batteries that you have in your home. It charges, you know, you can charge it up with solar power, and then you can sell some energy back to the grid if you wanted to, or you can hang on to it, you know, for a rainy day. The other thing that we're seeing is the ability of EVs to actually provide power in situations. The Ford F-150 Lightning, which is their all-electric truck, can actually power your house for about 2 or 3 days, depending on, you know, how much power you have. You know, if you're blasting, you know, the Xbox on a huge TV, it won't last that long. But if you're just running the refrigerator and a couple of other necessities, then it can power, and it can also send power back to the grid. So it's kind of neat to have the ability to take, you know, your power with you or to store the power at your house. But, you know, the battery technology, there are so many different areas that scientists are looking at, you know, with the lithium batteries, the nickel batteries. There are so many different ways, and it's really just about which battery is correct for the situation. So the type of battery that works in your house to store power, if it's able to draw that power and slowly be filled up throughout, that's a different use case than a battery you might want in your car where you'd want it to be able to be charged very, very quickly. And so it just really kind of the best technology is really situational, depending on how the battery is going to be used.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's go to Jay in Chicago. Jay, you're interested in towing capacity.
Hi, yeah, just a quick one. Another battery technology uses salt water, which is fairly plentiful. But I was wondering about, we're looking at buying a hybrid, and specifically there's a Kia Niro. and it lists, we have a 1,500-pound pop-up camper, and it lists no towing capacity. You're not supposed to tow with this car. But if you look at the Australian specs, it says the car can tow 2,700 pounds. And it appears to be the same engine and everything, nothing different as far as that goes. Do you have any idea why that would be so much different between one country and another?
You know, that is actually really interesting, because you have to be a little bit careful, because different countries measure different capacities differently. So, for example, the same exact car will have a different horsepower rating in the UK than it does here. So if Kia isn't publishing a towing capacity for you, and just really quickly, you know, I looked online and I found that, you know, a couple of forums are saying that it can, you know, tow up to 1,300 pounds. But to be honest, I would not do it. If you tow with it, you're going to void your warranty. And Kia is going to, you know, kind of leave you out in the cold if anything goes wrong with it. You know, I think there's a very, you know, there's likely an engineering reason why they aren't listing the towing capacity and why they don't want you to tow with it. I'd be very curious to see, and I apologize because I haven't spent a lot of time underneath or behind a Kia Niro, but if they even have the right setup, you know, for towing available there. So it's not something that, you know, I would tow with. If you have another car that you can tow the camper with, I think that would be a better way to go. If you're absolutely, you know, if you're absolutely committed to towing with it, just know that you could be voiding your warranty, and to make sure that, you know, you can really check, you know, get that camper as light as you possibly can, and, you know, maybe don't drive it up any mountains or anything like that.
Are there any vehicles, Jamie, you would suggest that are good for towing?
You know, a number of EVs are good for towing. The one that really just leaps into mind is that Ford F-150 Lightning truck. Mm-hmm. It can tow up to 7,700 pounds. So that is, you know, in line with what a lot of other trucks are offering. And in a lot of cases, a pure EV is a better towing vehicle, because EVs create more torque. Torque is the force that gets the car rolling. And anybody who's towed a heavy load before, you know, it's coming from a stop. Actually taking off from a stop, that is difficult while you're towing, because it's getting that little bit of momentum going. But because the EVs make more torque, you're able to accelerate from a stop much better than you would in a gasoline powered car. And so I would check out, you know, if you really want an EV for towing, I would check out the Ford F-150 Lightning. I would check out the Ford Mustang Mach-E for, you know, light towing, because there are, you know, really good EVs out there. If you felt like, you know, going for a Tesla, the Model X has a decent towing capacity. Again, you know, none of these are going to be towing semi-trailers or really big boats, but, you know, for a camper, a couple of jet skis, they'll do okay.
Let's go. Jay, thank you for that call. Let's go to Randy in Kakana. Randy, hi.
Good. Great topic today. I did want to real quickly before I make my point, you know, people always, I have an EV, a plug-in hybrid, and people say, well, don't you burn coal, you know, to charge it up. You know, we're relying less and less on coal for energy in this country. And the last I heard as a national average, we're down to about 20% coal now in this country. And eventually, I think everything will be replaced by renewables. But anyway, my point is this, is that I was looking at a Tesla Model Y and a Toyota RAV4 Prime, which is a plug-in hybrid. And I told myself I'd go with whichever made itself available to me first. Turns out the Toyota RAV4 came in, and it's just what I wanted. Toyota claims an electric range of 42 miles. But with regeneration, I have been getting my last charge. I got 66 miles on a charge, and I've got a gas engine to back it up. So my day-to-day driving is like I'm running on 90 to 95% electricity. And the only time I need the ICE engine, the internal combustion engine, is when maybe I'm doing a longer trip. So the combination of the gas engine and the battery power, I'm getting a 600 mile range on that. And I just plug it in overnight, 110, and it's good to go. Plus,
Randy, because we're short on time, and I want Jamie to respond. Jamie, what do you make of those numbers?
I mean, Randy is preaching to the choir. These plug-in hybrids, in my opinion, are the perfect bridge vehicle for people who, you know, are waiting for the charging infrastructure to be better before they go to a full EV. Because, like Randy said, you're getting, depending on the car, you know, anywhere of a stated all-electric mileage, anywhere from, you know, 20 to 40 some miles, which is well within the range of what most people drive in a day. And when you're over that range, you've got a gasoline engine that can work for you. The other flip side of these things is that electric motor for a lot of automakers, they actually used to juice the performance of the car. So my current dream car, the one I'll get next time I need a car, is the Volvo V60 Polestar. This is a Volvo station wagon that makes over 500 pound-feet of torque and you know, just about 500 horsepower in a Volvo station wagon. And it does that because it's a plug-in hybrid, and it's got this electric motor that can work in tandem with the engine. So electrified vehicles, you know, whether they're EVs or plug-in hybrids, they still give you that kind of driving excitement that a lot of people really love about, you know, driving a fun and fast car. So you don't have to give up on that. And again, with the plug-in hybrids, you don't really have to worry about the charging infrastructure because you can either charge or you can go ahead and use a gas station.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
So thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Jamie Page Deaton is editor-in-chief of Car Talk. Still ahead, how to make EVs affordable to a larger segment of Americans. We talk about the sticker price with an economist who has research on adoption of plug-in electric vehicles. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Policymakers espouse EVs as a solution to climate change, but are the models out there only targeting affluent drivers? Is this holding back the transition away from gas-powered vehicles? Tamara Sheldon is an associate professor of economics at the University of South Carolina's Darla Moore School of Business. Research projects relate to climate change and adoption of plug-in electric vehicles. Tamara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good morning. You've studied incentives that are aimed at encouraging people to buy EVs. Traditionally, have tax incentives actually worked? Have they encouraged people to buy electric cars?
They have worked, but in a very limited manner. It turns out, you know, these are very popular, but very expensive incentives. So the federal tax credit, you know, the way that it's structured is that you buy an EV, and next year, come tax time, you get a credit of up to $7,500. Well, it turns out you only actually get the $7,500 if you owe that much in taxes. So a lot of moderate income families, if you have a mortgage interest deduction or dependents, you don't actually owe that much in tax. So you don't actually receive the full $7,500. A recent congressional research report showed that about 80% of these tax credits are going to households that make well over $100,000. And so really, you know, the tax credits have proven popular, but they're really going to people who would buy electric cars, even if they weren't getting the tax credits. So to a certain extent, it's kind of just throwing federal dollars away.
Hmm. So President Biden signing into law the Inflation Reduction Act and providing this new round of tax incentives for EVs, how do its incentives differ from what were previously available?
Well, so we have a number of important changes. The amount of the tax credit has pretty much stayed the same, up to $7,500, depending on battery size. One change, though, is that rather than waiting until tax time, you can actually get the tax credit up front at the point of sale. So that's going to be helpful because, you know, some people who are on the margin of being able to afford these vehicles, they can't wait till tax time to get that $7,500 back. They need it now. So I think that's one thing that's really helpful. Another thing that the Inflation Reduction Act has done is they're capping the income of households in terms of who's available for these incentives. So I mentioned in the past, you know, we're just spending so much money giving subsidies to households who don't really need them. So going forward, households making above a certain amount of money won't be eligible for them. And they're also implementing vehicle price caps. So your most expensive EVs, your luxury EVs, are no longer going to qualify for these incentives. So that's going to improve the cost effectiveness of the incentive program. Another thing that the Act does is it makes used EVs eligible for a tax credit for moderate and low income households. So if your income's below a certain amount, you can actually get up to a $4,000 tax credit for a used EV. And of course, you know, used cars make up 2/3 of the vehicle market. Mm-hmm. And most moderate income consumers are buying used cars, not brand new ones.
That to me is the really interesting incentive there. And I'm just wondering, could it bring in to the EV market more, you know, low income, middle income buyers?
I think so, absolutely. You know, like I said, about 2/3 of the market, of the vehicle market, are for used EVs. So the one hesitation I have about this policy is that what we might see happen is the sellers of these used EVs are going to jack the prices up, right? So you have your Nissan Leaf, you're done with it, you want to buy a new Tesla, you go to sell your Nissan Leaf, and you say, well, hey, if I sell it to someone who gets a tax credit, I can charge them a higher price for it. So I have some concern that this benefit is not going to exclusively go to these used vehicle buyers. I definitely think it's a step in the right direction. I think a better policy would actually be subsidizing the financing of loans, of auto loans. So for households who have to finance their vehicle purchase, whether new or used, give them a 0% interest loan or a low interest loan that they couldn't otherwise get. Make it cheaper for them to pay off their car payments. And that it'll be harder to take advantage of that in the pricing of the new vehicle market.
What about the cars needing to be assembled in the U.S. or built with, you know, critical components that are sourced domestically? What effect might this have on EV sales?
Right. So there's, you know, as of August of this year, final assembly has to happen in America for the vehicles to qualify for the federal subsidy. Going forward, there's going to be increasingly stringent requirements on, the critical minerals being sourced from certain free trade partners, and more of the battery components having to be produced domestically. And I think, yes, this is good in that it can help encourage domestic battery production technology and create more independence in the U.S. But this is going to be really confusing for consumers. Already it's unclear exactly which vehicles are going to qualify for how much of a subsidy. So it's going to be confusing. And I think that on net, fewer vehicles are going to qualify for the subsidies, which is going to slow down the adoption of EVs.
Tamara, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Economist Tamara Sheldon there at the University of South Carolina, and her research interests are environmental and energy economics interacting with public policy. Earlier, we had Car Talk's Jamie Page Deaton. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.